and somewhat tedious, he eventually collected all the details he needed. Next fall, when Illinois begins to issue temporary visitor's driver's licenses to undocumented residents, Trooper Wilson says his job should get a little bit easier.
We also have a pretty strong Indian population with the John Deere businesses that are in our area, the factories or the computer software portions. So we just have to work with what we can use as our resources. And sometimes it's the interpretation bank. Sometimes it's being able to find an officer that speaks that language. Sometimes we might be able just to have them write out what they need and very basic information, and we can get it that way too.
We have to kind of... Skiles Driving School, this is Brandy.
Brandy McGuire runs Skiles Driving School in East Moline. She says a small number of her customers are adults, such as international students from Augustana College, and the foreign students bring her a lot of joy, including engineers and IT professionals who work at John Deere.
They're men of a few words because they don't speak very good English a lot of times. So, when they come in and they finally pass their driver's license test, you know, and Doug will bring them in here, you know, and they'll put their hands up in the air and they'll go, "Yay, I did it!" You know, and they're just so excited, and we don't get to see that as often, you know, and it's very rewarding. It's very rewarding to watch them. They just light up. They're so excited when they get it, you know.
But she also hears stories of tragedy and violence that have forced the foreign nationals to seek refuge in the U.S.
A lot of these people don't get any practice because they don't know anybody here who has a car. That's why we get a lot of the foreigners that they don't. They don't have anybody that's got a car. They even use our car to take the test in because they don't have anybody here. So they don't get that practice they need. Whereas the teens, they even have to have 50 logged hours that they practice with their parents before they're allowed to get their license. So they have to wait 9 months. They have to have 6 hours with a professional instructor. And then they have to have 50 logged hours with their parents, 10 of them at night. And then we allow them to get their license. So, you know, as an adult, you turn 18, you take the permit test, you take the behind-the-wheel test, you're done.
McGuire says all adults who are new to driving should be required to take at least 6 lessons, and not just people who don't speak English.
Most of them, after 3, they don't need any more. They're fine. They decline. But we make them sign a paper that says they declined 6 lessons because, you know, really by law, we would prefer them too as a company to take 6 lessons just because, you know, that's what we do with our teens. And every lesson is designated to a different task. You know, whether it's country roads, it's not just driving up and down John Deere Road and that's it. But every lesson is designated. You know, you've got one ways, parking, all the different tasks that they need to learn. So we would rather them take 6.
Overall, she says Illinois' requirements are pretty good. And now, no matter what their status, immigrants will be able to apply for temporary visitor's driver's licenses. One Black Hawk College student from Africa spoke French and went to Skiles for help translating the rules of the road. McGuire says he rode his bike to class and his job at the Hy-Vee in Silvis. It took months, but recently he got his learner's permit.
And then he comes back here again wanting to get his license, but he has to have a car, he has to have insurance, you know, and all those things. So he's saving all of his money, you know, and working part-time. And it's just kind of a... kind of inspiring, I think. You know, it's like the American dream. You know, I think we kind of lose sight of that sometimes. These people who come here, you know, and, you know, have next to nothing, you know, and he's trying to do it, but he's doing it the correct way.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
To hear all of our stories from Harvest Public Media and Illinois Public Radio, visit us online at will.illinois.edu. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Chris Berube. Now, doctors and lawyers kind of live in very different professional worlds. They have different languages that they use, different words that come up in their professional practice. A compatible medical-legal partnership may sound like an oxymoron. But in hospitals and clinics across the country, doctors are actually hiring lawyers to join their practices. They argue that a lawyer may be just the prescription for some patients with needs. Jeff St. Clair of NPR member station WKSU has this report.
As a TV drones in the background, about a dozen women and children wait for their names to be called at the Summa Women's Clinic in Akron. In the clinic's conference room, Meredith Watts is awaiting her next case. She's not a doctor or a nurse. She's a lawyer.
I specialize in housing and in some consumer work.
Watts works for Community Legal Aid, a nonprofit that gives free legal help to low-income people in 8 Ohio counties. Her firm is housed in a downtown office tower, But Watts prefers working out of here.
So if somebody comes into the clinic and they get sent to me and it's a housing problem and I'm here, I can give them advice directly on site.
Meredith Watts' role on the team is to help solve issues that might affect a patient's health but are outside a doctor's control.
Let's say you're under threat of eviction because of something that happened. That's going to cause a significant amount of anxiety potentially, and then you're suffering from these anxiety problems that wouldn't have happened if we had been able to intervene and perhaps help with the eviction problem.
And as a lawyer, Watts makes house calls. We meet client Shirley Kimbrough at her subsidized housing unit in a North Akron neighborhood.
Okay.
The clinic referred Kimbrough to Watts, who last year helped her move into this handicapped accessible apartment to care for her disabled granddaughter.
If I hadn't had her to help me, I would have lost my granddaughter because I had already lost my daughter, and I don't think I could have stood that.
Attorney Maria Curry runs Akron's Medical Legal Partnership. Rather than chasing ambulances, she tries to keep vulnerable clients out of them.
It's exciting to be able to do what we think of as preventative law, rather than always being crisis intervention, because you can help something not happen before it becomes a crisis.
But not all lawyers are quick to embrace a cozy new relationship with their old adversaries.
I don't understand how a medical clinic needs an attorney to be a part of its team. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Alan Schulman is a malpractice attorney in nearby Canton who takes a more traditional view of the two professions.
I think there has historically been an animosity between lawyers and doctors. I think we share some of the blame, and I think the medical profession shares some of the blame.
But back at the Akron Women's Clinic, physician Michelle McCarroll likes having a lawyer down the hall from her examination room.
In the sense that we are trying to meet the needs of the patients right here on site in kind of a one-stop shop where we know things that make a difference, such as social issues, can make a difference in health issues.
McCarroll and Akron's community legal aid lawyers have enrolled 100 women in the first randomized study to determine whether having a lawyer on site really does improve health outcomes. They're measuring things like blood pressure, stress, and other health factors in two groups of women who had legal issues. One group was introduced to a clinic lawyer. The other group was given a number for the legal helpline. They'll present the results next week at the National Medical Legal Summit in Washington. For NPR News, I'm Jeff St. Clair.
In Cambodia.
Jeff St. Clair works out of WKSU, that is Ohio Public Media.
In Cambodia, a pioneering bank gives big mortgages to low-income people. It also makes a profit.
You're giving somebody something they never thought they could have. So no matter what the hardship is, what's the one bill they're not going to miss? They're not going to miss their mortgage.
Financing dream homes for people who live in shacks today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 4th of April, 2013. It was on this day in 1818, Congress decided the flag of the United States would consist of 13 red and white stripes and 20 stars with a new star to be added for each new state. It's the birthday of the novelist and memoirist and screenwriter Marguerite Duras, born in a little village in French Indochina near what is now Saigon in 1914. Parents were teachers. Her dad became ill. He died. Dumas had an impoverished, miserable childhood in which she was abused by her mother and her brother. And when she was a teenager, she became lovers with a wealthy, older Chinese man whom she met on a ferry boat between Sa Dec and Saigon. She wrote about him in her books The Sea Wall, North China Lover, and The Lover, which was published in 1984. It's the birthday of Maya Angelou, born Marguerite Ann Johnson, St. Louis, 1928, whose memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, was a big bestseller in 1969, a book that begins, "When I was three and Bailey four, we had arrived in the musty little town wearing tags on our wrists, which instructed to whom it may concern that we were Marguerite and Bailey Johnson, Jr. from Long Beach, en route to Stamps, Arkansas, care of Mrs. Annie Henderson. Our parents had decided to put an end to their calamitous marriage, and father shipped us home to his mother." It was on this day in 1968 Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, standing on the balcony of his room on the second floor of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis at 6:01 in the evening. He'd gone to Memphis to support a strike by black sanitation workers, and the night before he'd given a speech in the Masonic Temple in Memphis in which he said, "I just want to do God's will. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land." And it's the birthday of the blues great Muddy Waters, born McKinley Morganfield in Rolling Fork, Mississippi, 1915. Taught himself to play harmonica and guitar, played on the south side of Chicago in bars, and in 1950, he made his first recording for Chess Records, a tune called Rolling Stone. Here's a poem for today by Christina Rossetti, entitled Uphill. Does the road wind uphill all the way? Yes, to the very end. Will the day's journey take the whole long day? From morn to night, my friend. But is there for the night a resting place, a roof for when the slow dark hours begin? May not the darkness hide it from my face? You cannot miss that inn. Shall I meet other wayfarers at night, those who have gone before? Then must I knock or call when just in sight? They will not keep you waiting at that door. Shall I find comfort, travel sore and weak? Of labor you shall find the sum. Will there be beds for me and all who seek? Yea, beds for all who come. Uphill, a poem by Christina Rossetti. That's the Writer's Almanac.